Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Rainwater, Executive Director with the group Peace Action, who discusses the mixed signals sent by the Trump administration regarding the dropping of preconditions to begin negotiations with North Korea. Ellen Brown, President of the Public Banking Institute, who talks about the advantages of public banking over for-profit financial institutions and the current effort to establish public banks in New Jersey and other U.S. cities. And Ronnie Neff of the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, who examines the link between meat consumption and the typical Western diet and climate change. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Dozens of Shiite militias in Baghdad, loyal to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, are celebrating the downfall of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. During the height of the ISIS advance into Iraq, Shiite militias resisted the drive for a new caliphate as Iraq's government troops melted away. While the United States and its allies waged an air and ground campaign to defeat ISIS, Iran may be the ultimate winner after the downfall of the Sunni terrorist group. Iran's leaders convinced Shiite Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon and fighters from across the Middle East and around the globe to defend Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria. Now Assad, Shiite militias, and Russian air power have succeeded in pushing ISIS out of Syria. Since the nation's 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran had met with only limited success to expand its influence across the mostly Sunni Islamic world. But today, after the defeat of ISIS and diminishing U.S. leadership, Iran is outmaneuvering its chief rival, Sunni Saudi Arabia, emerging as a dominant regional power. South Africa's African National Congress turned a page when the party's members elected former Nelson Mandela advisor Cyril Ramaphosa as its new leader and their candidate to be South Africa's president in 2019. Ramaphosa defeated Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, a veteran politician and former wife of current South African president Jacob Zuma. Yet Ramaphosa, backed by many middle-class blacks, failed to win a clear mandate for change, winning by just 179 ballots out of 4,708 cast. The top ANC positions are now split between reformers who backed Ramaphosa and supporters of President Zuma, who is mired in corruption scandals. With a stagnant economy and 30% unemployment, many middle-class blacks and the business community have drifted away from the ANC to support opposition parties in local elections. President Zuma and his friends have been accused of putting state-owned enterprises and other government institutions in the hands of people who are allowing them to loot public funds. Estimates are that between $11 and $15 billion have already been stolen, with some global corporations also implicated. In his ANC acceptance speech, Ramaphosa, a founder of South Africa's powerful mine workers union, pledged to root out corruption, including state capture from selected individuals and families. During a Black Lives Matter protest in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to protest the killing of 37-year-old Alton Sterling, a confrontation spread onto the lawn of onlooker Lisa Batiste. She was sitting on her porch with her adult daughter, but soon her front lawn became the scene of a melee between Baton Rouge police and African-American activists. Well before the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement, which protests against police violence, local law enforcement in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, have employed militarized tactics like SWAT teams who use tear gas, armored vehicles, and police patrols with rifles, disproportionately impacting communities of color. A series of reports by mental health researchers has revealed a link between police violence and symptoms experienced by victimized communities, including post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Chronic stress in marginalized African-American communities can lead to substance abuse and distrust of public institutions, including law enforcement. Psychology professor Sean Utley of Virginia Commonwealth University sees long-term stress as causing limited social mobility as residents become nervous about venturing outside of their own communities. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Before the Christmas holiday, there was a brief sign of hope that dangerous rising tensions between the Trump administration and North Korea might be about to ease. On December 12, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson issued the following statement at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Quote, "We've said from the diplomatic side, we're ready to talk anytime North Korea would like to talk. We're ready to have the first meeting without precondition." Tillerson's comments were uncharacteristically conciliatory toward Pyongyang, given the fact that during his first speech at the United Nations in September, President Trump had threatened to totally destroy North Korea. But not long after Tillerson's overture to the North, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Mr. Trump's position on North Korea was unchanged and that negotiations were pointless if the North's leader, Kim Jong-un, continued to menace his neighbors. The disconnect between Tillerson and the White House exposed ongoing public disagreements in the administration on the proper U.S. approach to North Korea. The discord also focused renewed attention on reports that the administration was considering a plan to replace Tillerson at the State Department with CIA Director Mike Pompeo and fill the vacancy at the CIA with conservative Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. Your reporter spoke with John Rainwater, executive director of the group Peace Action, who assesses the mixed signals sent by the Trump administration on beginning negotiations with North Korea, with the goal of de-escalating tensions over Pyongyang's nuclear weapons and missile program.
There have been, rising tensions. We're closer to war with North Korea than we ever have been, and both sides, particularly the two heads of state, have been engaging in the most egregious sort of language towards each other. And Tillerson did recently make a statement in a speech that he was willing to negotiate, that the United States was willing to negotiate, and he used the words without preconditions. And this is very welcome. It was actually the dropping of preconditions in negotiations with Iran that led to the breakthrough of starting to talk to Iran, that led in turn to the breakthrough of having the nuclear agreement with Iran. People may remember that George W. Bush had put on a precondition with Iran to require Iran to end enrichment of uranium, and that did not work very well. During that entire period, Iran just went ahead with its program and created more and more uranium, more lower enriched uranium, much of it, but they did not listen to the preconditions. And so those type of preconditions don't work. Tillerson came to the table, so to speak, although it was in a speech, saying we could drop preconditions. Now, he left some wiggle room, and then in a subsequent statement, he talked about making sure that there's an end to missile tests before getting to the table, which sounds an awful like a precondition. So we are getting mixed message, not only from the administration as a whole, but with Tillerson himself. So it's a little disappointing, but at least he's pointing to this opening. So we have to push the administration to really engage in direct talks.
Do we have any indication of what exactly the conflict is between the White House and Tillerson at the State Department?
I think some of it is just on atmospherics and posturing, because a lot of this can happen behind closed doors. So you had a situation again with Iran where the Obama administration started reaching out to counterparts in Iran to set up negotiations. And some of that work is apparently happening, or something analogous is happening with North Korea, where there's some at least lower level contacts. So knowing exactly where the president is at is hard to say. I mean, you've seen a lot of these tweets by the president criticizing, in a sense, diplomacy that Tillerson's engaging in. You have a lot of aggressive tweets basically downplaying diplomacy. And so clearly there are those in the administration that don't yet want to drop preconditions, and there's some kind of tug of war going on with the State Department. But I certainly don't know exactly who's where within those debates.
John, what concerns do you have about the coming period? There's a lot of commentators who talk about the Russia investigation targeting the inner circle of Trump in the White House, and that the president himself may be charged with one crime or another related to collusion between his campaign and Russia. Is there a concern that in the wag the dog style, we might see more bellicose rhetoric targeting North Korea and the conceivable triggering of a conflict that would in effect be a way to distract the American people from the scandal-plagued White House and where the Mueller investigation may be headed?
I think the wag the dog scenario is very real and something we should be very concerned about. I'm hopeful that the attention that everybody's giving it, I mean, the fact that that's one of your, you know, big questions, means that people will be ready for it and ready to say, wait a second, you're just trying to distract us here. We can't have war with North Korea. So I think we have to demand diplomacy now before it gets to that state. And if the administration starts talking about war, we, the public, need to put pressure on our members of Congress to push back.
That was John Rainwater, executive director with the group Peace Action. For more analysis and commentary on the dangerous rise in tensions between Washington and North Korea, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For many Americans, Wall Street and giant U.S. banks are the hated symbol of unbridled greed, which are often implicated in ripping off average workers. For example, Wells Fargo, one of the nation's largest banks, was fined $185 million in civil penalties in 2016 for secretly opening millions of unauthorized deposit and credit card accounts that harm their customers. Other familiar names in the banking industry, such as Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup, have all been hit with millions of dollars in federal fines for engaging in improper conduct in recent years, including behavior that triggered the subprime mortgage collapse that led to the 2008 meltdown of the global economy. While there's no shortage of criticism of the big financial institutions, some progressive economists and activists have proposed alternatives to private for-profit banking to better serve the interests of consumers, small business, and the nation as a whole. Among those ideas is an option known as public banking, inspired by the successful example of the Bank of North Dakota, the nation's only statewide publicly owned bank, established in 1919. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Brown, chair of the Public Banking Institute, who discusses the pledge made by Governor-elect Phil Murphy of New Jersey, who says he'll work to establish a public bank in the state and other cities across the U.S. that are also working to adopt North Dakota's public banking model.
And public banks are banks that are owned by governments, as opposed to, it doesn't mean a publicly listed bank. It means it would be a city-owned bank or a state-owned bank, or it could even be a national bank. Globally, 25% of banks are publicly owned. In the 1970s, there were 50% of banks were publicly owned, but then we went through a wave of privatizations, and it's now down to 25%. So we're behind the curve in having only one, which is the Bank of North Dakota, which has been around for a century now. But we do have quite a bit of interest in public banking. But probably the biggest news was that in New Jersey, Phil Murphy ran as a Democrat for governor and won, and he made a state bank a centerpiece of his platform. We're looking on to see how that works. I mean, hopefully he'll be the first and everybody else will, or the second, and everybody else will see how well it works and jump on. Phil Murphy was a banker at Goldman Sachs, so right. He understands how banking works, and I think that's why he was so quick to pick up on the idea, whereas generally speaking, most people don't understand how banking works and they don't trust government. I mean, even legislators themselves, they have this perception that we're talking about putting bureaucrats in charge, which we're not. We're talking about putting seasoned bankers doing actual banking. So the major advantage of a public bank, what you do is you take your own revenues, the state's own revenues or the city's own revenues, and you put them in a bank, which allows you to leverage your money by a factor, technically by a factor of 10. So let's say if you had $1 billion, let's say, you could either keep that in a loan fund, lend it out at 3%, wait for the money to come back, lend it out again. That's what every city has loan funds, and that's what they do. But you could take that same money, put it in a bank, and then you can lend out 10 times that much. That's what banks do. Or it actually works out to you would make about 5 times what you would make with a revolving fund. So it's lucrative. You can save a lot of money on infrastructure. 50% of the cost of infrastructure is financing. So if you are doing it yourself, if you own the bank, you get to finance that money back. So you can save up to 50%. In theory, it would be 50%. Instead of it going to your deposits and your capital going to a Wall Street bank, which might be investing overseas or might even actually be doing things that hurt the state, you have no control over where they put that money. But if you put it in your own bank, you can make loans as needed in your state. So you can generate credit for your local community where you need it and make a profit for the city or state.
With the election of Phil Murphy in New Jersey as governor, as you said, he ran on a platform of establishing a public bank for the state of New Jersey. What exactly was he saying were the benefits? Were there any specifics coming out of the campaign pledge to establish a public bank?
Yeah, well, the three things he said he would focus on were infrastructure, student loans, and affordable housing. So all things for which there is a big need. Some of those things may sound like they're risky, but that's the thing. If you're a banker, you understand that there's a way to do all those things that isn't risky.
There are a number of U.S. cities that you're in touch with that are interested in establishing public banks, including Los Angeles and Oakland, California, Seattle, Washington, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. Give us an update on what's the status of the move towards establishing a public bank in these municipalities.
Mm-hmm. Well, the farthest along would be Santa Fe. They've done it. They've got a feasibility study approved. They established that it would be a moneymaker for them, which is a very small city. So if it's a moneymaker for them, it's basically a moneymaker for anyone. But where they are right now is figuring out all the relevant laws and how they can comply with all the laws. So they're sort of in the technical part now of actually setting up a bank. In Oakland, they got $75,000 approved for a feasibility study, so they're proceeding with that. In Los Angeles, the city council has approved looking at a city-owned bank. And in Seattle, too, they're just looking at it. But the state they got $75,000 for a feasibility study approved. And so that's what they're proceeding with now.
You've been at this for a long time. do you have a sense that the wheels are turning finally?
So hopefully, yes. It's one of those things where it needs to percolate up before people get the idea of what you're talking about. Like, for example, when I was up in Washington State, other times when we've presented to legislators, you do get a lot of pushback and a lot of questions. But in this case, everybody was so positive. It's like, okay, how do we do this? I mean, they're just looking at the way forward rather than being hesitant and seeing obstacles.
That was Ellen Brown, chair of the Public Banking Institute. Learn more about the effort to establish public banks across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The focus of the 2017 American Public Health Association annual meeting, held in November in Atlanta, was public health and climate change. The conference featured panels on various aspects of that topic, some exploring the link between agriculture and climate change. Ronnie Neff, who directs the Program on Food Systems Sustainability and Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, participated in a discussion on a panel titled Food in the Environment that, among other issues, examined how human dietary patterns could be leveraged to mitigate climate impacts. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the conference and spoke with Neff about a study she was involved in that looked at the coverage, or almost total lack thereof in U.S. newspapers, of agricultural impacts on climate change, especially animal agriculture, and what can be done to raise awareness and minimize the inclusion of animal protein in the typical Western diet.
So this was published in 2009, and it was soon after the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization had come out with its report, Livestock's Long Shadow, which found that 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions were attributable to livestock alone. And they've since revised that to 14.5%, but whatever, it's still incredibly high. And so we wanted to see, you know, how come we're not hearing about that? Is that just my imagination or is it real? And so we looked at, I believe it's 16 different major publications over a long period of time, and we found basically that 0.5% of the articles that address climate change mentioned anything to do with livestock.
And is this in the U.S. or globally?
This was U.S. newspapers.
Do you attribute that to anything in particular, or did you draw any conclusions, or do you have any ideas about why that's true?
Yeah, I think it's how we've been thinking about climate change from the very beginning has really been about carbon dioxide. And so it's a kind of a leap to start thinking about some of the other greenhouse gases that are very powerful, but they're released in much smaller amounts. So I think that some of the experts and leaders who have started the field of working on climate change weren't thinking as much about food and agriculture. And it's just kind of self-perpetuated. I worked closely with Linnea Lestadia, someone who's now a professor when she was a doctoral student, and she wanted to understand why non-governmental organizations weren't talking about this, even when they worked on climate change, or they worked on food, or they worked on animal welfare. But they weren't putting those pieces together to talk about the impacts of food on climate change. So those were some of the things that we found, and we also found that there's an issue where the staff themselves, we have such strong feelings in this country about what we eat. People themselves maybe weren't ready to make those changes. And she also found that they were concerned about what their donors would think, because maybe those donors also like their meat.
I've been a vegetarian for 45 years. Going from meat eater to vegetarian was so much easier than going from vegetarian to vegan. I don't know, cheese is really a challenge. So, like you were saying, people don't want to change their diet. They don't want to know the impact, especially in terms of red meat. But I know there's also a pretty big impact from dairy. I heard that it's not so much, it's more burping than farting. Is that true?
It is.
Is it possible to give the cows something to make them have fewer eruptions like that? Or is it just part of the four-chamber stomach?
Yes, the quality of the feed does have something to do with how much methane is going to be emitted from the cow, absolutely. And so there's a lot of work going on to try and figure out ways to formulate the feeds in ways that may be more digestible. There's pros and cons of that, because ultimately we probably, for many reasons, because of the many environmental impacts of the way we produce meat, may need to reduce the number anyway. So even if we get those feeds perfectly formulated, we're still going to have a problem. And the third thing is that many of these organizations, these advocacy organizations, consider their domain to be policy work. And they said, well, food, that's individual. and they didn't really see that there could be policy or big picture or systemic types of work that they could do to address what we eat. So, and that's a challenge throughout working on food, is that everybody sees it as just somebody wagging their finger at them, telling them what to eat, as opposed to looking at the system.
If people who eat meat knew that there are better and better meat substitutes that don't involve animals at all, do you think that that is a viable way to move more people off of animal protein?
There's a lot of different types of approaches that can be helpful. And so if there are meat substitutes that are palatable, that are also low in greenhouse gas emissions and also taste good and affordable, that can be a win-win. Those pieces don't always go together as much as we might hope, but that could be a goal. Many people say that they don't know how to cook vegetarian meals, or they think, we've done some survey research, people just think, well, those meals are boring. And also, there's a lot of people that think that a meal is not healthy if it doesn't have meat in it.
I'm making a face when you said people think vegetarian meals are boring, because I think, you know, the meat and potatoes with, you know, canned green beans or whatever that a lot of us grew up on is really boring. And I think vegetarian food is just phenomenally creative and delicious.
I'm with you. And I think that there's just this renaissance of people creating interesting recipes and really finding ways to bring out the flavors of the foods. Anybody that's interested can look on the internet. You'll find a lot of really appealing recipes.
In terms of talking about systems as opposed to individual choices, what would you like our listeners to take away?
I think the first thing to know is how incredibly large of a footprint animal agriculture has compared to, and particularly beef production, compared to any other food, and even compared to the overall set of things that are emitting greenhouse gas emissions, like agriculture has a higher footprint than transportation. So that's number one. Number two is that there's so much that we can do, whether it's finding ways to eat more appealing vegetarian meals, whether it's looking at reducing the amount of food that we waste, because we waste 40% of our food supply in the United States. There's a lot that we can do.
That was Ronnie Neff, who directs the Program on Food System Sustainability and Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. For more information on the links between meat consumption and the typical Western diet and climate change, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KOPA in Pala, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.